Chapter 19. We rested and otherwise refreshed ourselves 2 or 3 hours at Keen, but by that time the news was abroad that the young girl commissioned of God to deliver France was come. Wherefore, such a press of people flocked to our quarters to get sight of her that it seemed best to seek a quieter place. So we pushed on and halted at a small village called Fierbois. We were now within 6 leagues of the king, who was at the castle of Chinon. Joan dictated a letter to him at once, and I wrote it. In it she said as he had come 150 leagues, to bring him good news, and begged the privilege of delivering it in person. She added that, although as he had never seen him, she would know him in any disguise, and would point him out. The two knights rode away at once with the letter. The troop slept all the afternoon, and after supper we felt pretty fresh and fine, especially our little group of young Domremians. We had the comfortable tap room of the village into ourselves, and for the first time in 10 unspeakably long days were exempt from boatings and terrors and hardships and fatiguing labors. The paladin was suddenly become his ancient self again, and was swaggering up and down, a very monument of self-complacency. Noel Reingesson said, "I think it is wonderful, the way he has brought us through."
"Who?"
asked John. "Why, the paladin." The paladin seemed not to hear. "What had he to do with it?" asked Pierre Dark. "Everything. It was nothing but Joan's confidence in his discretion that enabled her to keep up her heart. She could depend on us, and on herself for valor, but discretion is the winning thing in war after all. Discretion is the rarest and loftiest of qualities, and he has got more of it than any other man in France, more of it, perhaps, than any other 60 men in France. Now you are getting ready to make a fool of yourself, Noel Reingesson," said the paladin, "and you want to coil some of that long tongue of yours around your neck, and stick the end of it in your ear, then you'll be the less likely to get into trouble." "I didn't know he had more discretion than other people," said Pierre, "for discretion argues brains, and he hasn't any more brains than the rest of us, in my opinion." "No, you are wrong there. Discretion hasn't anything to do with brains. Brains are an obstruction to it, for it does not reason, it feels. Perfect discretion means absence of brains. Discretion is a quality of the heart, solely a quality of the heart. It acts upon us through feeling. We know this, because if it were an intellectual quality it would only perceive a danger, for instance, where a danger exists. Whereas, hear him twaddle the damned idiot," muttered the paladin. "Whereas, it being purely a quality of the heart, and proceeding by feeling, not reason, its reach is correspondingly wider and sublimer, enabling it to perceive, and avoid dangers that haven't any existence at all, as, for instance, that night in the fog, when the paladin took his horse's ears for hostile lances, and got off, and climbed a tree. It's a lie. A lie without shadow of foundation, and I call upon you all to beware you. You give credence to the malicious inventions of this ramshackle slander mill that has been doing its best to destroy my character for years, and will grind up your own reputations for you next. I got off to tighten my saddle girth. I wish I may die in my tracks, if it isn't so, and whoever wants to believe it can, and whoever don't, can let it alone. There, that is the way with him, you see. He never can discuss a theme temperately, but always flies off the handle and becomes disagreeable. And you notice his defect of memory. He remembers getting off his horse, but forgets all the rest, even the tree. But that is natural. He would remember getting off the horse, because he was so used to doing it. He always did it when there was an alarm and the clash of arms at the front. Why did he choose that time for it?" asked John. "I don't know. To tighten up his girth, he thinks. To climb a tree, I think. I saw him climb 9 trees in a single night." "You saw nothing of the kind. A person that can lie like that deserves no one's respect. I ask you all to answer me. Do you believe what this reptile has said?" All seemed embarrassed, and only Pierre replied, he said, hesitatingly. I hardly know what to say. It is a delicate situation. It seems offensive to me to refuse to believe a person when he makes so direct a statement, and yet I am obliged to say, rude as it may appear, that I am not able to believe the whole of it. No, I am not able to believe that you climbed 9 trees. There, cried the paladin. Now what do you think of yourself, Noel Rangesson? How many do you believe I climbed, Pierre? Only 8. The laughter that followed inflamed the paladin's anger to white heat, and he said, I bide my time, I bide my time. I will reckon with you all, I promise you that. Don't get him started, Noel pleaded. He is a perfect lion when he gets started. I saw enough to teach me that, after the third skirmish. After it was over, I saw him come out of the bushes and attack a dead man single-handed. It is another lie, and I give you fair warning that you are going too far. You will see me attack a live one if you are not careful. Meaning me, of course. This wounds me more than any number of injurious and unkind speeches could do. Ingratitude to one's benefactor, benefactor? What do I owe you, I should like to know? You owe me your life. I stood between the trees and the foe, and kept hundreds and thousands of the enemy at bay when they were thirsting for your blood. And I did not do it to display my daring. I did it because I loved you and could not live without you. There, you have said enough. I will not stay here to listen to these infamies. I can endure your lies, but not your love. Keep that corruption for somebody with a stronger stomach than mine. And I want to say this, before I go, that you people's small performances might appear the better, and win you the more glory. I hid my own deeds through all the march. I went always to the front, where the fighting was thickest, to be remote from you in order that you might not see, and be discouraged by the things I did to the enemy. It was my purpose to keep this a secret in my own breast, but you force me to reveal it. If you ask for my witnesses, yonder they lie, on the road we have come. I found that road mud, I paved it with corpses. I found that country sterile, I fertilized it with blood. Time and again I was urged to go to the rear, because the command could not proceed on account of my dead. And yet you miscreant, accuse me of climbing trees. Pah! And he strode out, with a lofty air, for the recital of his imaginary deeds had already set him up again, and made him feel good. Next day we mounted and faced toward Chinon. Orleans was at our back now, and close by, lying in the strangling grip of the English. Soon, please God, we would face about, and go to their relief. From Guine the news had spread to Orleans that the peasant maid of Vaucouleurs was on her way, divinely commissioned to raise the siege. The news made a great excitement, and raised a great hope, the first breath of hope those poor souls had breathed in 5 months. They sent commissioners at once to the king, to beg him to consider this matter, and not throw this help lightly away. These commissioners were already at Chinon by this time. When we were halfway to Chinon, we happened upon yet one more squad of enemies. They burst suddenly out of the woods, and in considerable force too, but we were not the apprentices we were 10 or 12 days before. No, we were seasoned to this kind of adventure now. Our hearts did not jump into our throats, and our weapons tremble in our hands. We had learned to be always in battle array, always alert, and always ready to deal with any emergency that might turn up. We were no more dismayed by the sight of those people than our commander was. Before they could form, Joan had delivered the order, forward. And we were down upon them with a rush. They stood no chance, they turned tail and scattered, we plowing through them, as if they had been men of straw. That was our last ambuscade, and it was probably laid for us by that treacherous rascal, the king's own minister and favorite, de La Tremouille. We housed ourselves in an inn, and soon the town came flocking to get a glimpse of the maid. Ah, the tedious king and his tedious people! Our 2 good knights came presently, their patience well wearied, and reported. They and we reverently stood as becomes persons who are in the presence of kings, and the superiors of kings until Joan, troubled by this mark of homage and respect, and not content with it, nor yet used to it, although we had not permitted ourselves to do otherwise since the day she prophesied that wretched traitor's death, and he was straightway drowned, thus confirming many previous signs, that she was indeed an ambassador commissioned of God, commanded us to sit. Then the Sieur de Metz said to Joan, "The king has got the letter, but they will not let us have speech with him. Who is it that forbids?" "None forbids, but there be three, or four that are nearest his person, schemers and traitors every one, that put obstructions in the way, and seek all ways, by lies and pretexts, to make delay. Chiefest of these are Georges de La Tremouille and that plotting fox, the Archbishop of Reims. While they keep the king idle, and in bondage to his sports and follies, they are great, and their importance grows. Whereas if ever he assert himself, and rise and strike for crown and country like a man, their reign is done. So they but thrive, they care not if the crown go to destruction and the king with it. You have spoken with others besides these? Not of the court, no, the court are the meek slaves of those reptiles, and watch their mouths and their actions, acting as they act, thinking as they think, saying as they say. Wherefore they are cold to us, and turn aside, and go another way when we appear. But we have spoken with the commissioners from Orleans. They said with heat, "It is a marvel, that any man in such desperate case as is the king can moon around in this torpid way, and see his all go to ruin without lifting a finger to stay the disaster. What a most strange spectacle it is. Here he is, shut up in this wee corner of the realm like a rat in a trap, his royal shelter this huge gloomy tomb of a castle, with wormy racks for upholstery and crippled furniture for use, a very house of desolation, in his treasure 40 francs, and not a farthing more, God be witness. No army, nor any shadow of one. And by contrast with his hungry poverty you behold this crownless pauper, and his shoals of fools and favorites tricked out in the gaudiest silks and velvets you shall find in any court in Christendom. And look you, he knows that when our city falls as fall it surely will except succor come swiftly France falls. He knows that when that day comes he will be an outlaw and a fugitive, and that behind him the English flag will float unchallenged over every acre of his great heritage. He knows these things. He knows that our faithful city is fighting all solitary and alone against disease, starvation, and the sword to stay this awful calamity, yet he will not strike one blow to save her. He will not hear our prayers. He will not even look upon our faces. Apostrophe, apostrophe, that is what the commissioner said, and they are in despair." Joan said, gently, "It is pity, but they must not despair. The Dauphin will hear them presently. Tell them so." She almost always called the king the Dauphin. To her mind he was not king yet, not being crowned. "We will tell them so, and it will content them, for they believe you come from God. The Archbishop and his confederate have for backer, that veteran soldier Raoul de Gaucourt, Grand Master of the Palace, a worthy man, but simply a soldier, with no head for any greater matter. He cannot make out to see how a country girl, ignorant of war, can take a sword in her small hand and win victories, where the trained generals of France have looked for defeats only, for 50 years and always found them. And so he lifts his frosty mustache and scoffs. When God fights it is but small matter, whether the hand that bears his sword is big or little. He will perceive this in time. Is there none in that castle of China who favors us? Yes, the king's mother-in-law, Yolande, Queen of Sicily, who is wise and good. She spoke with the Sieur Bertrand. She favors us, and she hates those others, the king's beguilers, said Bertrand. As she was full of interest, and asked a thousand questions, all of which I answered according to my ability. Then she sat thinking over these replies until I thought she was lost in a dream, and would wake no more. But it was not so. At last she said, slowly, and as if she were talking to herself, a child of 17, a girl, country bred, untaught, ignorant of war, the use of arms, and the conduct of battles, modest, gentle, shrinking, yet throws away her shepherd's crook, and clothes herself in steel, and fights her way through 150 leagues of fear, and comes she to whom a king must be a dread and awful presence, and will stand up before such an one and say, "Be not afraid, God has sent me to save you." Ah, whence could come a courage and conviction so sublime as this, but from very God himself? She was silent again a while, thinking and making up her mind. Then she said, "And whether she comes of God or no, there is that in her heart that raises her above men, one high above all men, that breathe in France today, for in her is that mysterious something that puts heart into soldiers, and turns mobs of cowards into armies of fighters, that forget what fear is when they are in, that presence fighters who go into battle with joy in their eyes and songs on their lips, and sweep over the field like a storm. That is the spirit that can save France, and that alone, come it whence it may. It is in her, I do truly believe, for what else could have borne up that child on that great march, and made her despise its dangers and fatigues? The king must see her face to face, and shall." She dismissed me with those good words, and I know her promise will be kept. They will delay her all they can, those animals, but she will not fail in the end. Would she were king, said the other knight, fervently. For there is little hope that the king himself can be stirred out of his lethargy. He is wholly without hope, and is only thinking of throwing away everything, and flying to some foreign land. The commissioners say there is a spell upon him that makes him hopeless, yes, and that it is shut up in a mystery which they cannot fathom. "I know the mystery," said Joan, with quiet confidence. "I know it." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.